Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how the financial crisis, like those that came before it, was really a political crisis. We spend the hour analyzing the failures of democracy that allowed it to happen and what reforms are necessary to prevent it from happening again. The Great Recession of 2008 was not merely a financial crisis, say our next guests. Similar to the Great Depression and the savings and loan crisis, it was caused by a set of conditions that dominate our political process. Some are embedded in the U.S. institutions, but others are ideological in nature. What are the political causes of the financial crisis? That's the subject of a new book, Political Bubbles, Financial Crises and the Failure of American Democracy. With us are the authors, Nolan McCarty, Keith Poole, and Howard Rosenthal. Nolan McCarty is a professor of politics and public affairs and associate dean at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Keith Poole is a professor and distinguished chair of political science at the University of Georgia. And Howard Rosenthal is professor of politics at New York University and professor emeritus at Princeton University. In addition to their latest book, Political Bubbles, they also co-authored Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. Let's start with the basic concept of the book. The financial crisis, you say, while driven by the financial industry and others, was really also a political crisis. So let's start with this general argument. How much was this economic bubble also a political bubble? Nolan McCarty, you want to start us?
Sure. What we argue in the book is that really any type of financial crisis like the one we saw in 2007, 2008 requires some sort of political underpinnings, whether it's the regulatory institutions are not functioning, whether or not it's policymakers throwing fuel on the fire by promoting policy interventions that promote the bubble. Whether it's easy monetary policies, which contribute to the rise in asset prices. There's always a set of political decisions which undergird and promote the crisis. So we saw that in 2007, 2008. And as we detail throughout the book, that's really a commonality of many of the other financial crises that we've seen in U.S. history.
Howard Rosenthal?
I would just add that the political responsibility is a very long process, and without legislation that started to be passed in 1980 when Carter was still president, none of the products that underpinned the financial crisis, variable rate mortgages, you know, the various kinds of derivatives, none of those products would have been possible. So it took congressional action to make the crisis possible.
Keith Poole.
Yes, in contrast, for example, the crisis of the 1930s, there was a failure of Herbert Hoover and the Republican Party to respond quickly enough in terms of doing something about the banking system. And so the crisis just simply continued until the election of Franklin Roosevelt. And this one, as Howard pointed out, it was a long buildup. Deregulation and increasing in complexity, financial instruments, partly due to better worldwide communication. And then when the crisis hit, it was right before a presidential election, and the incoming president, President Obama, did not take advantage of the situation to really simplify and clean up the financial system as Franklin Roosevelt had done.
I'm glad you went back to that because I wanted to do the comparison that you started to do in the book as well. You noted in the book the Great Depression, but also the savings and loan crisis. What would you say was also similar or different in these three? You just gave us some of the differences in the Great Depression example. What about the savings and loan one?
Let me follow up with one point that Howard just made, which is an important theme in the book. A lot of economic commentators about the financial crisis tend to look for causes to financial crises that take place within a year or 2 years before the crises and kind of dismiss these kind of long-term trajectories and factors that we focus on in the book. And so we think that's one of the important contributions, is to say that these things don't happen overnight. They take a long time to build up. And there lies one of the big similarities with the savings and loan crisis. The savings and loan crisis was a situation that was created by decisions to deregulate the interest rates paid on deposits at a time of high inflation, and caused massive losses to savings and loans who were locked into long-term loans and having to pay high interest rates on deposits. But the crisis wasn't resolved very quickly because Congress continually, as a result of political interest and political pressures, kicked the can down the road, basically ignored the problems through a variety of regulatory measures, deemed that there were no problems until it was too late, and the massive losses in the savings and loans accumulated. So really, our bottom line is to focus on these long-term trajectories and to understand, these problems don't occur overnight, and they're often aided and supported by the political process.
This is Howard Rosenthal. Also out of the savings and loan crisis, we learned that when Congress does react to the crisis with what was called the Faraea Act in 1989, it basically gives in to lobbyists and doesn't really address the underlying causes of the crisis. And in fact, in 1989, Congress set up the regulatory structure with institutions like the Office of Thrift Supervision that encouraged regulatory venue shopping by the financial institutions. And so the legislation that followed the savings and loan crisis actually encouraged the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008.
When you went through some of the three basic problems that you see, the political elements that facilitated 2008, you call them the three I's, ideology, institutions, and interests. It sounds like here what we're talking about are institutions, but why don't we back up just a bit and talk about the ideological element and then connect these two together. Ideology, you said in the book, was really essentially rigid and unresponsive to new information. It sounds a bit like religion, really. So what is the ideology or ideologies that affected this financial crisis? Nolan McCarty?
We identify several strands of ideology in American politics that were important. Perhaps the most important is what we call free market conservatism, which is the belief, very strong belief in the virtues of deregulation, lower and lower taxes. That ideology, we argue, was really important in this particular crisis because it not only permeated much of the Republican Party, but spilled over into large parts of the Democratic Party. It made it much easier to pursue the deregulation of financial markets that took place throughout the 1980s and in the 1990s. The reason why we use these terms of rigidity to describe it is, as we note in the book, there were several instances throughout the 1990s and 2000s, for example, that showed the dangers of derivative securities. We identify three or four episodes in the decade of the 1990s. Yet at the same time, policymakers were convinced of their virtues and didn't update with respect to the new evidence. So it's this kind of rigidity in the virtues of unregulated financial markets.
Could you just back up and tell us what the evidence that you saw in your research that they disregarded?
Well, sure. There were major blow-ups related to derivative securities during the 1990s, such as the Orange County bankruptcy. There was a major lawsuit where Procter & Gamble sued Bankers Trust over some very bad derivatives. There were other major instances like that. And then, of course, there was also the long-term capital management crisis of 1999 that required the Federal Reserve to intervene in order to facilitate a private bailout of a hedge fund. So all of those episodes were percolating. As is well known, Brixley Bourne, who was the head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission at the time, started pointing to this evidence of the dangers of derivative securities, but her efforts to have her agency to regulate them were pushed back both by the Clinton administration and were eventually outlawed during the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. So, you know, that's, I think, a very good example of the role that ideology played in leading to the origins of the crisis.
It seems to me there was also this ideology in particular leadership places. You specifically noted Alan Greenspan, who was the Federal Reserve Chair at the time. What happened with him?
Well, this is Howard Rosenthal. You know, Greenspan was identified with the idea that markets could be self-regulated. You know, there are two things that government might do to sort of make financial markets work better in the public interest. And one is to simplify the product structure so it'll be easier to regulate, less complicated to game, have fairly simple rules for regulation. And the other is supervision. You know, so the idea is that, you know, financiers are not going to be reckless and that part of the ideology has never been publicly contradicted, because you can't sort of preach to this dishonesty of the public. You know, there's President Obama shortly after the crisis said that the crisis was only the fault of a reckless few. I don't think that that's the case. And more supervision is required, but Alan Greenspan thought that no supervision was required. So you had the whole subprime mortgage industry, about which there were warnings from other governors of the Federal Reserve System, such as Edward Gramlich, that were simply ignored. The performance of companies like Countrywide was just ignored.
Keith Poole, that sounded like you.
Yeah, let me make a general point here about the appeal of the sort of deregulation free market ideology. Remember, as far back as the latter years of the Carter administration, there was widespread agreement about deregulation. So it was under President Carter that passed the Staggers Act, which deregulated the railway industry for the first time since the 19th century, and has been astonishingly successful, to the point where Warren Buffett just bought Burlington Northern Santa Fe. And it was under the Carter administration, they also deregulated trucking, which I think most people agree has been a big success. And they ended the Civil Aeronautics Board. And then during the Reagan years, basically we had an economic boom beginning roughly late 1983, that lasted uninterrupted till the year 2000, with the exception of two down quarters under the first Bush, that seemed to essentially, there became a consensus on the part of a Democratic and Republican executive branch officials, that deregulation and this unregulated economic activity was a positive, good thing. And so it's not a surprise in that context that this would spread into the financial industry in general, and why Alan Greenspan was as hardcore as he was about essentially economic deregulation, economic freedom, unrestricted government not restricting markets and so on.
So it sounds like, yes, in fact, ideology is acting like a religion in a way, as a political religion, where it's just blinding people from reality. Would you say that's true?
Howard Rosenthal again. You know, there's an aspect of the ideology that we haven't discussed. We've discussed the idea that free markets should operate. Another aspect of this ideology is that government should not intervene. There should not be bailouts, that if there are bailouts, it's going to create a gigantic problem of moral hazard. So this aspect of the ideology probably impinged on the ability of the Bush administration and Secretary Paulson and Ben Bernanke to deal with the crisis, so that when Bear Stearns was bailed out, there was a very negative reaction within Congress, and it's possible that the administration then could not deal with Lehman Brothers as they might have wanted to. And finally, when Lehman Brothers crashed and the roof fell in on the financial markets more generally, we had to have this thing called TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. And there was enormous resistance in Congress to doing TARP. It failed. The Dow Jones dropped 800 points when they first rejected it. And then it was finally enacted. And all this comes out of a part of ideology that says one should never intervene in a financial crisis, an ideology that was carried over from Andrew Mellon in the Great Depression. And I don't think there's any evidence to support the idea, but as you said, it's like religion. It's a belief.
Well, let's now go to the institutional aspect of this, which is, I think, the part that people have some sense about, but maybe an exaggerated sense about aspects of. In fact, you even said, you know, it's not just that campaign contributions are all powerful and people are just purchased. There's all of these complexities that are involved with the institutions that make it difficult for policymakers to make change. So why don't we start with the elections themselves? Perhaps this is the first place to start. Keith Poole?
Yes, I think you have to say the elections are the first place to start. One of the things that we highlight in our book is the fact that the financial industry in particular has been becoming more active in terms of campaign contributions to both political parties. And indeed, there was a piece in the New York Times that showed these freshman Republicans cashing in from the financial industry, so that there is, in order to be elected these days, it costs a great deal of money. And most of these members of Congress are fundraising almost constantly from the day that they assume office. So that despite all the rhetoric, Congress continues to rely on these moneyed interests, to be quite blunt, to finance their electoral activities. And it's telling that there hasn't been a really strong push to break up the banks and simplify the financial industry, and I think the money is a large part of that.
This is Noel McCarty. I want to add one thing of where elections is a really important part of our story, and it relates back to ideology and its rigidity. As we point out in the book, you really don't get reform following a financial crisis until you have an election that repudiates the current administration. So one of the fortunate things about the 2008 crisis was that it happened right before there was an election, there was a transition to a new administration, and some of the necessary reforms were able to take place in a way that it's inconceivable that it would have happened had there been a Republican administration continue in office for several years, like happened during the Great Depression when Herbert Hoover had his crisis the first year of his first term, and then the reforms that were necessary couldn't take place until the election of Franklin Roosevelt almost 4 years later. So elections are a very important part of the story, because it's really the only way in this kind of ideologically rigid political system we have that we get the opportunities to reform and change.
The campaign contribution specifically for the financial industry seems to be, that whole industry seems to be much more financially able to support the candidates on both sides, but also they're just really well organized for the number of people that we're talking about. Howard Rosenthal?
You mean that people in the financial services industry participate a little bit more in politics than most other people in the society? That's certainly true. And what really happens, if you look at these Wall Street firms such as Goldman Sachs, It's not that they're linked to one of the two political parties, but the individual high-ranked employees of these firms, some of them are Republicans and some of them are Democrats, and there was a lot of noise about the fact that Wall Street turned against President Obama for the 2012 elections, but it's not exactly what happened. People who were always Republicans just contributed a lot more to Romney than they had contributed to McCain in 2008, and people that were always Democrats contributed somewhat less to Obama, but very few people switched their allegiances. And that means that in addition to campaign contributions, there were, to go a little bit astray from your question, there are always people in these firms, it's true of Citicorp as well as Goldman Sachs, that are available to go through the revolving door back to Washington and make policy. And they're not too likely to be too strict with their former employers or their future employers.
When we come back, what are the political causes of the financial crisis? Stay tuned. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. We spend the hour analyzing how the financial crisis, like those that came before it, was really a political crisis. That's the subject of a new book, Political Bubbles, Financial Crises and the Failure of American Democracy. With us are the authors, Nolan McCarty, Keith Poole, and Howard Rosenthal. At the beginning of the interview, we started to talk about the Lehman Brothers. And now they were one company that wasn't able to survive through this. So they're not all powerful. Others have been rescued. Why some and not others? Keith Poole?
I think in the case of Lehman Brothers that there's been enough biographies and inside accounts after the fact that that was a big mistake not bailing out Lehman Brothers. They, as Howard, I believe, mentioned earlier, they did bail out Bear Stearns, and then the blowback from Congress was such that the criticisms that Paulson and Bernanke and Geithner, who was the head of the New York Fed, felt like they, where hands were tied, they had to let one of these banks go under, but that turned out to be an utter catastrophe, and the whole system started to unwind within weeks, so that to tie this back to ideology, neither political party had basically a platform, if you like, or a point of view, if you like, of let's simplify the financial system and limit its financial power. Neither political party pursued that, so that what you see in this confusing mishmash of reactions on the by the politicians and our major institutions as this thing fell apart in late 2008 is fundamentally incoherent. They didn't, the Democrats, when they did get control, didn't go for simplification. Instead, they went with an extremely complex bill that, in the end, is going to help the financial interests. And the Republicans were just basically almost useless in the crisis. They just stuck to the same old, singing from the same old hymnal. So that it's, in this case, the ideology got in the way of practicality, and the practicality never came through.
This is Nolan McCarty. I just add one thing to what Keith said. The stated reason that Bernanke and Paulson gave for not bailing out Lehman was that they lacked the legal authority to rescue an insolvent investment bank. Of course, in a well-functioning political system, one could obtain the legal authority by going to Congress and persuading them of the importance, but given polarization and paralysis in Washington, that wasn't an option. They could only go to Congress after the fact for TARP. And as Howard mentioned earlier, even there it was initially denied, and it took a massive collapse in the Dow Jones to get Congress to go ahead and promote it. So again, the tie-in between the ideology and the rigidity and the dysfunction is really important.
The other aspect about the lobbying and the financial contributions that we haven't talked about was the amount of information that legislators rely upon these special interest groups like the financial industry to inform them. Can you help us understand how this facet plays a role in what has happened?
This is Noel McCarty. I think this is a very important part of the story. Just is one anecdote in Bob Kaiser's very good book about the passage of Dodd-Frank, there's a scene in which Obama administration officials come to Chairman Barney Frank, who's the head of the House Banking Committee and in charge of writing legislation, and ask for permission for the administration to write the bill. And Representative Frank said, "You bet the administration's going to write the bill. There's no way that Congress can do this themselves." So it's just a fact of life in Congress that they really don't, even on even some less complex areas, have the expertise to write the legislation themselves and to see it through. So a lot of the key decisions and development was done by administration officials who are part of this revolving door. So there was really a strong, I would say, pro-industry bias in the drafting of the bill. That resulted primarily because there weren't people involved with the information, the expertise, who didn't have those biases.
So this is Howard Rosenthal. Let me just break in. The information is not just the information that Congress needs when it's drafting the bill, but the information is required after Congress gets done and creates this 1,500-page monster, for example, that's Dodd-Frank. So some of your listeners who are now in law school will be spending their entire careers on this. They will get very specialized information to deal with this that will not be transparent to the general public. They'll make lots of nice money dealing with it, and everything will go on to the benefit of financiers and lawyers.
This is Keith Bull. I'd like to follow that up because I think this is one of the most crucial points we make in the book. This is about information and money and the power of money. The banks, the financial people, have got almost an unlimited supply of money. They can buy the best attorneys, the best mathematicians, the best computer programmers, the smartest financiers on the planet. There is no way that a government agency or the staff of the committees on Capitol Hill can possibly match this, basically this expertise. Furthermore, in these regulatory agencies and on the Capitol Hill, the staffers who have talent, what they want is they want jobs with these banks. And so that their interest is not making the banks necessarily too unhappy, but at least demonstrating the fact that they would love to be able to come work for Goldman Sachs or Merrill Lynch or one of these places. That's the important, that's the thing about Dodd-Frank that your listeners have to absolutely understand. This thing, even though it's spun as anti-financial industry, this sets up a fundamental asymmetry of information that helps the financial power and undercuts smaller, basically, financial institutions and other businesses. And it's really a case where money can buy just about anything. In this case, it basically buys you the brain power. As Howard said, there will be all these sharp young lawyers who are listening to us that are going to spend their lives working on Dodd-Frank-related issues.
Well, this actually brings up a couple of issues. One is, does it help to explain why leaders, say a President Obama, end up hiring people in their top echelons who are from directly the banking industry? And what I mean by that is, does the president really understand all these instruments? And does he need people from the industry to help to dissect that for a guy who is actually a constitutional lawyer?
I'm speaking out of turn, but I'll just say yes. And all you have to do is take a look at the Academy Award-winning documentary, Inside Job. The Frontline did a four-hour special on this. There was a recent one where Frontline did a special called The Untouchables. That's the point we hammer home in the book is that if you really wanted reform, you would break up the banks, you'd make the regulations simple, you would outlaw certain kinds of derivatives, and you'd take away this power these people have over the rest of the economy.
Well, then that brings me to something that you asserted in the book, which is even if we had fully publicly funded campaigns and full information, say, I think you even said PhDs on the staffs, PhDs in finance, we'd still have difficulty in preventing another crisis like this. So what else is there that we're not getting across? Nolan McCarty?
I think that's a terrific question. We could certainly take the money, private money, out of campaigns and to take away some of the power there. We could certainly improve greatly the expertise within regulatory agencies and within Congress. But in the end, the financial sector plays a really important role in the economy. It's really it's a much bigger share of corporate profits and GDP than ever before. And so I think any kind of rational policymaker is going to kind of treat the financial sector specially because of the effects that it might have on the macroeconomy. So you think about an emerging bubble. What you would really want to have is a regulator who is going to be able to spot that bubble, understand that these asset prices are higher than they should be, and that there's policy instruments available to them to do something about it. The problem is that it's going to be very difficult for them to spot the bubble. There's going to be political pressure not to intervene. Because any intervention is going to cause losses in some sector of the economy. You see that somewhat today with the discussions about when and whether the Fed should stop its bond buying program. There's a lot of pressure for the Fed to continue because it seems very clear that that's been propping up stock prices for the past few months. So anytime the Fed talks about unwinding that portfolio, the stock market crashes. And so it's that form of political pressure. What old Marxists used to call the structural advantages of capital that is going to make it very difficult for regulators to proactively supervise the financial sector.
It's also what funds people's pensions, and it's what funds the philanthropic world. So it's really a very complicated situation. But there's also the lawmaking process that has so many veto points. Howard Rosenthal, can you talk about why it's so hard to pass reform from a regular congressional process?
Maybe most of us have learned at one point in our lives in high school, don't have a British system of government. And not only does the president have to propose legislation, but it has to be passed by two houses of Congress, which have different geographic bases of who the members are. And you have a filibuster in the Senate, and you have committees within Congress. So you have a very complex structure. And you need very large majorities or a very large crisis to move forward. And part of the problem here is that the financial crisis of 2007-2009 was not the Great Depression by any means. And when a new president took office, the new president decided that his priority was health care. And because of all these veto points and roadblocks and negotiations that are necessary, it took 14 months to pass the Affordable Care Act. And when that was done, the financial crisis was, to a large extent, behind us. there was less pressure to reform, and the financial industry had recovered, was able to exert more pressure, and we didn't get very strong reform with some of the things that Keith talked about, like breaking up the banks and making the banks smaller. So here we are.
So, Keith Poole, let's bring you back in. Now, if you are going to say what you thought the big issue was with somebody like President Obama that has prevented the reform, would you say it's some of these aspects like what Nolan McCarty was talking about in terms of fear of the economy continuing to downslide? Or is it some kind of capture? Is it afraid to upset people? What do you think has prevented President Obama from doing those reforms that you suggest?
I think that this has been fairly, again, I want to give a hat tip to the Frontline, which has done some good programs on this. I think President Obama, when he chose his advisors, he was playing it safe. He brought in Larry Summers and some of the experienced folks from the Clinton administration who had been very successful. And so he didn't, and although he had Paul Volcker, who was, I think, strongly in favor of much more stronger reform than Larry Summers, the whole Volcker did not, in the end, have as influential position as Larry Summers, so that the president, who I don't think, and I don't want to sound like I'm picking on him, I think it's fair to say that President Obama really wasn't an expert on banking and finance, and he was relying on folks that he regarded as experienced in that area, and he missed his chance, I think. And unfortunately, neither political party comes off very well here. The Republicans are absolutely hopeless, hopelessly divided, and the Democrats were sort of confused about what to do as well, so that there was a golden opportunity for presidential leadership, I think, in 2009, but unfortunately, the moment has passed, and the train has left the station.
This is Noel McCarty. If I could just jump in and add one additional thing. We criticized conservative ideology before, so let me criticize liberal ideology a little bit. I think part of the approach of the administration is rooted in a kind of a liberal faith in the ability of government regulation to solve problems. So they went straight for the classical playbook, which is to say, you know, we have a big, large financial sector. So what we need to do is just to come up with a better regulatory apparatus in order to monitor it and to intervene. And we'll, you know, staff this apparatus with good public-spirited regulators. They'll identify bubbles, and then they'll have the wherewithal to pop them. What I don't think that there was a lot of accounting for among the administration were the types of political risks and the political problems that we talk about in the book, the notion that regulators could be captured, that regulators might not have the proper expertise or incentives, that regulation itself is not going to be a panacea, but rather that there should be more fundamental reforms that put less reliance on regulation. So if banks are just smaller, if they're regulated either through capital requirements or other ways just so that they're smaller, then there's less need for regulation. Small banks can be allowed to fail. Small banks can be prosecuted for malfeasance. There's a lot less that regulators need to do. So I think part of it is just an over exuberant faith in the ability of government regulation to solve certain problems. Sometimes simple solutions are better. And you know, we argue that, you know, downsizing the big banks, making sure that financial products don't get too complex or esoteric would have been a much better solution than believing that all we needed was better regulators and better monitors.
Now, none of you have really talked about the what you called in the book this new set of dangerous interests that were created by the bailout, the mergers and acquisitions. What are these? Howard Rosenthal?
You know, the banking industry has become much more concentrated. You know, one number is that, you know, something like 37% of all residential mortgages in the United States are now written by Wells Fargo. And J.P. Morgan Chase is the second leading writer, and that's most of the market. So if these companies are in trouble, there isn't going to be easy way to deal with it other than another bailout. They know that in their behavior. And
so it's monopolistic behavior, you think?
So it's become monopolistic, and you can, you know, just walk down the street in your community and see how many different banks you have available to you. And many of those banks, you're going to find it very difficult to borrow from. So that's one thing that happened in the crisis, that the industry got more complicated. To go back to a point that you raised earlier, you know, Lehman Brothers stands out because it was a really big institution that was allowed to fail. But the, you know, Citicorp and Bank of America, which probably should have been failed, were not allowed to fail. That's part of the concentration of the industry. But at that time, there were tons of small guys that were either allowed to fail or absorbed by these bigger players. So we have now this industry that, you know, we have less of a market because we have less competition.
When we come back, could the Occupy movement have done what the Tea Party managed to do? Stay tuned. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. We spend the hour analyzing how the financial crisis, like those that came before it, was really a political crisis. That's the subject of a new book, Political Bubbles, Financial Crises and the Failure of American Democracy. With us are the authors, Nolan McCarty, Keith Poole, and Howard Rosenthal. We had a populist sort of uprising, a couple of ones, one from the left, one from the right. You addressed both of them. And you noted that the Tea Party actually elected people and became powerful, while the Occupy movement has not. What happened? Keith Poole.
Well, Occupy movement, which had great promise, it turned into this sort of anarchist kind of street fair. They turned down an opportunity. The labor movement wanted to organize and assist, and that could have built up some real pressure on the administration as well as Congress to go revisit this issue. But the left-wing occupiers were just so just anarchists and discredited themselves and fizzled out all across the country. And the Tea Partiers, they really didn't, as we document in the book, they really sort of were animated by the health care law and not by the big banks. It's only been recently that enough folks have woken up to what Howard just described that have started to raise the alarm, and there's actually now some bipartisan unease with this industrial concentration and, frankly, its economic power. But yet there does not appear to be, again, the train, I think, has left the station. And I don't see, this is just a personal opinion, that Congress is going to revisit and simplify the system at any time soon.
So your last chapter is titled How to Waste a Crisis. So how was this particular crisis wasted?
This is Nolan McCarty. Yeah, so, I mean, we identify several factors. One is one that Howard already mentioned, which was instead of tackling the problem in kind of the midst of the crisis or at the height of the crisis, the Obama administration decided to pursue health care reform first. To some extent, I think that was actually inevitable. I mean, health care reform has been the top Democratic priority for almost 40 years, and they certainly wanted to move on that, but it certainly had implications for their success, lack of success, in our view, on financial reform. The second we've already talked about as well, it's the types of people who staffed the administration were, as we've pointed out, were very comfortable with the financial sector the way it is. They certainly thought it could use some tightening of the regulations, some more regulatory capacity, but weren't particularly interested in the types of, you know, fundamental reforms which make a financial crisis either rarer or less severe in the future. And then the last thing that I would point to is they left so much of the decisions about how to implement Dodd-Frank were left to the regulatory agencies, which have still not completed many of the important regulations that were supposed to be in place to prevent future financial crises. The law firm Davis Polk has kept track. The last time I checked, something like 60% of the regulations that were required by Dodd-Frank haven't been implemented yet. And even some that have been implemented were watered down significantly. Let me give you but one example. There was a rule that was supposed to be in place to require buyers of credit default swaps to get multiple bids. Originally, it was envisioned that there might require as many as five bidders. This was to create some transparency in the market that had been absent. By the time the rule was completed, the number of required bids was down to two. And that's just one. That's just one regulation that is much weaker than many people anticipated. Because, you know, once all of these decisions were left to the regulators, the public had basically cleared the field. The only people that regulators talk to are people from the financial sector. Bart Chilton, who's one of the commissioners at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, reported in the speech that there are 99 financial market representatives for every one person who meets with him from a consumer-oriented group. So the deck was really stacked in favor of the financial sector to win out in the regulatory arena.
Anything you'd like to add, Howard Rosenthal?
I could one additional example, which the intent that went into Dodd-Frank was that you could avoid some of the bad mortgage securities by requiring the issuers of mortgages to have skin in the game. And the idea was that if you wrote a mortgage, you would have to retain ownership of 5% of that mortgage, and you could only sell off the other 95%. So if the mortgage went sour, you would have some stake in it. So you would therefore have incentive not to write bad paper that you could just routinely sell off to somebody else. Well, then it became, that's too severe because it's going to discourage the writing of mortgages. It's going to discourage risk-taking. So we won't apply that rule to what are called qualified residential mortgages. And then it became, you know, a question of discretion as to what would constitute a qualified mortgage. And so various rulemaking took place. And whatever the final outcome is, rather than having a bright line, you've got to keep 5%, there will be a thing, well, did what you sell qualify or did not qualify? It'll be subject to regulatory interpretation, and there will be pressure to loosen these rules as time goes by, and so you will possibly return to the bad practices that underpin the financial crisis. You don't see them very much now because, you know, as Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz observed in their classic volume, Monetary History of the United States, when the Depression hit, regulations enacted were not very binding on the banking industry because the bankers were so conservative themselves that they just didn't do terribly risky things.
And so, you know, credit has been tough to come by in the years following the crisis, and people are going to forget how bad things were, and they're going to start to take greater risks. And the structure of regulation that issued within Dodd-Frank is just going to encourage those things. And
this is
not too very much.
I can't help but pound the drum one more time for the basic point that this gives all the advantages to the banks and the financial firms. They can afford the lawyers and the financial experts with their, you know, Gucci loafers and their nice leather briefcases, and they can go in and just nibble this thing to death, as Howard documented, and the New York Times has been pretty good on reporting on this. These experts that the banks can afford can go to meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting and slowly nibble away at this thing until it's just horrendously complex and sets the stage for another crisis.
So we had two other things that came up over the Obama administration. One was the Consumer Protection Agency was created. The other was the person who was originally intended to head that, Elizabeth Warren, who didn't get it, ended up becoming elected to Congress. Some people thought, well, here's somebody who actually understands all of this, who is in the Senate. Do you see that making an impact, or is it too much of a drop in the bucket?
This is Noah McCarty. Well, Elizabeth Warren has made herself quite visible, you know, on these issues as a senator, both in hearings and in her recent co-sponsorship of the new Glass-Steagall Act, which is co-sponsored by her, Senator Cantwell, Senator King from Maine, Senator McCain from Arizona. So it got a lot of attention. My guess is it has zero chance of passing. In terms of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, it's been fairly active as a regulatory agency, and perhaps one of the few bright spots. It was one of the few things that was designed with an understanding of the political problems of regulation, in that it was placed as an independent agency and given Fed funding so that it wouldn't depend on Congress for its annual appropriations. So it's been a little bit more aggressive and successful than some of the other agencies. Of course, it had this rough start in that Elizabeth Warren was blocked from becoming the head. President Obama's second choice, Richard Cordray, was blocked from becoming the head and then was inserted during a recess appointment of legal dubiousness, which has only since been resolved because there was an agreement to confirm him a few weeks back. So we really will probably start to be able to evaluate its success going forward now that all of these uncertainties about its future have been fairly resolved.
The last question I really have is whether this is completely unique to the financial industry in terms of how much influence there is and how much power there is, or can you apply your research to any other interest group sector?
Well, I'll take a stab and then let Howard finish, and that is maybe the new sort of web-based powerhouses like Google, Facebook, eBay, and so forth. Perhaps that's an example.
Howard?
You know, I think it's a mistake to think that sort of it's business against consumers. Most of what happens in Congress and in regulatory policy involves competition between different sectors of the economy. So something that's been in the news today, for example, is that there's a controversy between exporters of natural gas, people who want to export natural gas, and Dow Chemical that wants to keep all the natural gas in the United States so it will pay lower prices for the natural gas. Who's going to win this battle is very difficult to say, but large resources will be spent on it, and the outcome will not be driven by what is best for the general public or for consumers, but which of these two competing interest groups will be most effective. So, as you pointed out, you know, a while ago in this interview, Lehman Brothers, which had made lots of campaign contributions at all, did not get rescued. Okay, so we don't know. So what can be applied to the rest of the economy is simply this idea that interests matter, and the other idea that matters is that ideology will be important in the sense that there will be, you know, sort of competition in this natural gas case between, you know, nationalism and protection and sort of being part of the global economy, and both sides will serve, use those ideas. But if we could actually crystal ball all these things, then we'd be trading on it.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, so much for being with us, Nolan McCarty, Howard Rosenthal, and Keith Poole.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nolan McCarty is a professor of politics and public affairs and associate dean at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Keith Poole is a professor and distinguished chair of political science at the University of Georgia. And Howard Rosenthal is professor of politics at New York University and professor emeritus at Princeton University. In addition to their latest book, Political Bubbles, they also co-authored Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @armudian.
Synchronizers, Samus.